Hello, Radiant Light Beings. Does everyone know that's Happiness by a good friend of mine, DJ Petey from moontribe.org? Well, I know you all are living awake. Just want to, and there he comes back again. He likes to come on twice. I don't know why, but technical difficulties. Well, my crown chakra has been tingling all morning. I've been up since about 6 and had amazing meditation. I've been getting a lot of writing done. Lot going on, but I know the tingle is also because of the guests that we're going to have on. She's an amazing woman, amazing being, on the path for quite a long time. And some of you that have been tuning into my show, you probably noticed I like having people on that are really walking the talk and have been on the path, studying, training, teaching for a long time, also doing their own inner work, their own clearing, their own, you know, that they're not in an ivory tower, you know, even if people try to put them there. They are aware of their own evolutionary process and aware of their own empowerment and what it took to get there to realize that. Because my thing is, I believe we're all enlightened. We're all in light. We're all living that spirit-led living if we allow it. So sometimes it's just like peeling the layers, right? That proverbial saying of peeling the onion to get to the core, the truth, the root of who we are and connect with that which is emerging through us as us. So we're all converging here. And I want to say hi to everyone also in the chat room, Sylvia, Teresa, wonderful to see you. And anybody else that's listening that I can't see, Elisa, great to hear you and see you all. So as you all know, Awakenings is airing every Wednesday and Friday now on Blog Talk, and then 12 to 1, and then a replay on Cosmic Dimensions every Saturday and Sunday. And those of you that are just tuning in, you can click to listen, or you can also call 347-539-5122. And also, I love questions. Email me questions, feedback, comments. And call in. This is all of our shows. Maybe we're talking now. Maybe we're more prominent. But it's all of us. It's all of our collective consciousness that is bringing this converging flow around. So let's get right to it. Today we have Dr. Reverend Myesha Hazard, who, as she puts it, after introduction of that, then drop the Dr. Reverend, and she's Myesha. But she is involved with transpersonal psychology, behavioral science, and metaphysics, and she's blended all that she's done as far as religion, comparative religions, telecommunications, education, performing arts. She's also techie like I am. Techie close to my heart. Just an amazing, aware being and a lot to share of the innate intelligence and how we are this, but connecting to this more and more and having an awareness of this and actually how to live with this awareness and how to tap in. She also teaches at the Agape Spiritual Center some amazing courses. So I really want to welcome Dr. Reverend Myesha. So let's see if we can get her online here. Myesha?
Hello, how are you, Michelle?
I am wonderful. Great to have you here.
Oh, I'm expecting to have a lot of fun.
Yes. And we've got some wonderful beings that are already in the chat room listening and some others that have called in. So we're ready to dive in. You know, I said earlier, my crown chakra has been tingling all morning. And then when I went on my meditation walk, I did an earlier meditation and then went on a walk and did a meditation walk. And I saw your face and I could just feel your energy. And I thought, woo, she's already present here. Already present.
Yes. All the way here.
So, yeah, totally.
So tell everyone.
Us just a little bit about how you got, because one of the things, and I just want to kind of jump to this, is that, you know, I've seen you talk a few times. But one time, and I think it was a couple of weeks ago, I came in on one part of the talk, kind of midway, and you were talking about channeling the information while you were going to school. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, that's what I do. I've done. But I never thought to do it for school. That was brilliant. And you were talking about how you knew so much of the test, the questions on the test, that sometimes the instructors, the professors, thought that you were cheating because you were so accurate as to exactly what was needed and wanted and what was going to be asked. So really what I'm kind of curious, too, and I know our listeners are also, is how did you get to where you are? What was your, I guess, awakening? What was your first awakening of your gifts and being dialed in? And then to come from more maybe of a traditional, conventional route to weave in this metaphysics and transpersonal psychology. How did that all come about, I guess?
Let me begin by saying that I'm not sure that I've ever lived a conventional life.
Okay.
From the exterior, if you read my bio, it might look that way. It might look like I started out as a traditional student and very much an academic, and that's the outer appearance. How did it all start? I think it started with the family I landed in. My father was a metaphysician, a mystic. His mother was a clairvoyant and a medium who worked with law enforcement people back in the very small place that they lived. I can't even call it a town because it's not a town. And so my father always said to us that everything was possible and that everything is available to us and that we are fully supported in our lives when we allow ourselves to be. So in our home, there was never a time when we could really say, I can't do something. That was not even allowed. There was it was always understood that we were to simply stop and be still and know that there was always a way. That my father was a Methodist minister as well, and he would say, you know, God will make a way where there is no way, which was not an unusual saying in the African-American community. I meet so many different people whose grandmothers or great-aunts or somebody or grandfather, somebody had said that to them at some point. So I began, I'm the youngest one in my family, and so I was the one that everybody took care of. And I have a sister who's just a little older than I am, who was my primary playmate. And I have to say that the most fortunate thing for me was that she was an extremely tolerant and loving older sister, which means then that when I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would make her wake up to talk to me, and I would tell her that I had been flying someplace and I had seen some very strange beings and it scared me, she would listen to all that I said to her, and she would never say, oh, that's really crazy, oh, that's stupid. She would listen, and when I would be afraid to go back to sleep, I would literally pull her eyelids open if she tried to go to sleep and make her talk to me until the sun would come up. And the fact that she let me live this long is absolutely amazing to me sometimes. So yeah, I lived in an environment where my father was also supportive of the fact that there was information that you could get that didn't come in ways that other people perceived as normal, that you could know what was going to happen in the future, that you could see things that were not in the physical realm. So that was the opening. Now, to be very specific, I'm not saying that as in elementary school that I always knew how to access this kind of information. But I do remember I was in Sunday school at a small Methodist church in Philadelphia, and I was 7. And the kids in the class were talking about flying. They wanted to know what it felt like to fly on an airplane. And so I went into this elaborate, detailed description of what it was like to fly on an airplane, you know, what the stewardesses did, you know, how you buckled the seatbelt and you know, how they served you the food and what the uniforms they wore. So when Sunday school was over, the teacher went to my mother and said, oh, it's so wonderful that, you know, your daughter's had a chance to fly on the airplane. And my mother said, what daughter? What are you talking about? And so the Sunday school You know, the Sunday school teacher said, "You mean she hasn't been on an airplane?" My mother said, "No." So my mother calls me over, and the teacher is saying, "You just lied." And I said, "I didn't lie." She said, "Yes, you did. You told a story," because we didn't say lie in those days. Why were you not truthful? And I said, "I didn't say I was on the plane. I said what it was like to be on the plane." And what I remember.
I love that.
That distinction?
Yes. Yeah, that was good.
What had happened was, as I was telling the other kids in the Sunday school what it was like, I literally was on an airplane. It was an out-of-body kind of experience, or you could say a non-local experience of another place, or maybe I was bilocated. That's probably the closer. Mm-hmm. I've never tried to put language to it until this moment. So I guess you could say by location. I was literally on a TWA airplane, sitting in the seat. I could feel the texture of the seat, even though I was sitting in my little bitty chair in the Sunday school room at this small Methodist church in West Philadelphia. So that was an experience that was clearly there. But I became very careful about how I handled those experiences after that, because I realized...
Oh, yeah, who you tell, yeah.
Yes, I realized it would be very easy for people to simply say that I had a wild imagination or that I lied
about
it.
Yeah.
So and then to go forward to where it specifically began to emerge, I was in high school, and my parents were civil rights activists, and my father was always moving us someplace where people didn't want us, or allowing us to have the great opportunity of being the first African Americans to show up someplace, which also meant they really weren't happy about it. So I was in a high school in Mainline, Philadelphia, out in the suburbs, right outside of Philadelphia, Lower Merion High School, just the same high school that Kobe Bryant went to. Not the same year, but the same high school. Anyway, if you have any basketball fans out there in the audience. Anyway, here's the point that I want to make. I spent a lot of time by myself because I lived in a neighborhood where we were the only African-American family, and the high school I went to had, when I got there, about 35 African-American students out of close to 2,000. Mm-hmm. And the other 34 African-American students who went to Lower Merion High School actually lived in Ardmore. They lived, almost, you could almost say, across the railroad track. And I remember when I arrived at school on the school bus the very first day, first of all, I got on the school bus and all the white kids looked and said, like, you know, well, where are you coming from? And the girl I sat next to said, well, you know, who does your mother work for? Because it was assumed that our mother had to be a live-in housekeeper. And I said, my mother doesn't work. And they said, well, who's your father the chauffeur for or the groundskeeper for? That gives you an idea of how it went. Well, I spent a lot of time by myself. When I got off the school bus that day, I was so happy to see the African-American kids, a group, coming towards the bus. It was like, yes, I'm not here by myself. And they immediately looked and said, you know, what you doing on the white folks' bus? And when classes started, I realized I didn't have any classes with any of the other African-American kids, and so by the time I got to lunch, and all of this will fit into the story, believe it or not, when I got to the lunchroom, and they all said, well, where have you been all morning? You're not in any classes with us. And I told them, and they were like, okay. Well, there became a kind of peculiar separation that took place. I seemed not to belong anywhere. So I spent a lot of time by myself. I was the youngest child. I was the only one who was home at that particular point. And what I found was sometimes I would be staring out the window and my parents would come in from different meetings that they'd gone to, and my mother would say, what are you thinking about? And I would say, nothing. And she would say, you can't think about nothing. And I would go, nothing. What I recognized is that I had learned, somehow I had slipped into that meditative consciousness, that stillness of mind. And what emerged within a number of months was I was sitting in a class, and it was a class called Bible as Literature. Though we read the Bible like 2 weeks, because the guy who taught the class was really wanting to teach existential philosophy, and so that's what the class became. And so I'm kind of bored and really depressed about my social life, which was non-existent. And sometimes I wasn't reading my book. Sometimes I wasn't doing my homework because I was just depressed. Mm-hmm. And I showed up one day at class, and we were reading something by Heidegger. And I had not read it. I said, we were
the
reading.
Philosopher.
They read it. Yes, yeah. The philosopher, the existential mm-hmm. philosopher. And somebody asked a question, and my hand flew up. And I was like, ooh. You know, I pulled my hand back down like, I don't know why my hand was up. I knew I hadn't read it. And my hand went up again, and I'm like, oh, man, who is doing this? So, of course, the teacher called on me, and suddenly I'm saying, well, Heidegger wrote that piece in his early period, and I'm going through this long discourse on what Heidegger meant. And that kept happening. I might not read it, but suddenly I would know all this background information. It didn't make me very popular in the class, but on one hand, they found it interesting. On the other hand, it was like, oh, God, she's going to the library and getting background information. She's not only reading the assignment, but she's doing extra research. Oh, we hate her, right? But I suddenly recognized at that point that something had opened. Now,
did you feel this opening?
You know, I didn't. It was
feel
so
it
natural.
Or how did you, it was just natural.
It felt so organic, so natural. There was a part of me as the observer who was looking at it and going, okay, this is really interesting. I didn't know I knew this. But when I got to college, as a teenager, it was a wonderful thing. I heard about this man. His name was Dr. Joseph Murphy, who wrote the book, The Power of Your Subconscious Mind. And somebody took me to hear him.
Mm-hmm.
And he made such sense to me because he began talking about this infinite intelligence that is available to everyone, that there's only one mind, and we're all using it.
Mm.
And we're using it
to
the degree of our awareness of it, to the degree of our belief in the possibility of it, that where we have limiting beliefs and ideas about who we are in the mental plane, who we are in terms of our mental abilities, then that, in a sense, creates a kind of subconscious filter around our use of this infinite cosmic mind. And he talked about how you could bring in any information that you really wanted simply by saying, your infinite intelligence in me knows everything I need to know and reveals it to me as I need to know it about a particular subject. So I began at that point, in my whole process of studying, I would spend, for every hour of studying, I would spend a minimum of 20 minutes kind of sitting in meditation and saying, I have this infinite intelligence within me, and this infinite intelligence knows everything there is to know about this subject. In fact, the textbook, anything that's in any book, has been brought in from this one mind. And I would even say, if I were preparing for a test, and this infinite intelligence not only knows everything there is to know about this subject, even things that have not yet been brought into the earth plane.
Yeah.
But it also knows what the professor is going to ask.
Yes.
And even more than that, what answers they're looking for. Because that's always the tricky part, you know.
Yeah.
You could have read everything about a subject or everything that was assigned, and then the teacher asks some arcane question because it's their little pet peeve or they're trying to catch you
always,
in a trick bag.
Always, right? Yeah, exactly. But now, Maisha, do you feel, I know I do, that what I want to get your take on this, that this way of living, you've lived this way, I've lived this way, many people that are in the chat room and are listening online have lived this way, some are awakening to living this way. Do you feel that this is going to be more predominantly the way of living and being?
You know, I think it has always existed for a great number of people. Inventions and discoveries and artistic creations have always emerged from this through this kind of process.
Right.
I think if we look at Albert Einstein, probably the best thing that ever happened to him was he didn't always go to class, which means that he hadn't been so deeply programmed with the knowledge that was already known, already being taught in the classroom, that he didn't leave, because he wasn't so indoctrinated. It left the space in his dreaming, in his musing, in his imagination, to receive new information. So I think it's always happened. Now, I think we're in a wonderful time. Our technologies, I think, mirror what is beginning to emerge in consciously amongst more and more humanity. So the fact that we have the internet, it's kind of my belief that the technologies that emerge really are outpicturings of abilities that are innately ours. For example, we have the telephone.
I believe that.
Right. We have the telephone because we are innately telepathic and clairaudient. But because many of us have not developed those capacities within us, especially in Western society, we utilize technology to be sort of the equalizer that makes the possibility of talking to someone in another part of the world a functional reality because we haven't developed the innate ability. So to me, traveling in cyberspace through internet surfing is like surfing within our own being in the cosmic mind.
Yeah.
So the more and more that the technologies begin to reflect those greater abilities, the more I think we will morph into a world where more people will organically begin to develop those same capacities of clairvoyance, clairaudience, telepathy, downloading cosmic knowledge, activating the information on really through the use of, through asking questions. I think inquiry is a process by which we tap in to specific bodies of knowledge within the cosmic mind.
Well, I think, and you mentioned programming, I think a lot of the programming has blocked this, just the socialization process and for some the familial process. I know years ago when I taught school, preschool and kindergarten, I'd have kids, they remember past lives. You know, I had some of them sometimes say, I'll never forget little Johnny Flores, Michelle, where's your other car? I had driven up, and I said, well, what other car? Because I knew consciously I didn't try, I did hear what some of the other teachers were saying. I just wanted to just put something in their mouth and say, oh, don't stop the flow. Anyway, he says, where's your other car? And I said, what other car? And he said, the one you had last lifetime, the other lifetime. And I said, oh, you know what? I'm not driving that anymore. In my head, I thought, jeez. Oh, we do have a call, Maisha. Let's
Okay.
Hi, 203-755, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Keisha, Coach K. I was in the chat room.
Oh, hi, Coach K.
I just wanted to call in, and talk to, is it Maisha?
Maisha,
yes.
Yes, and say hello, and thank you for sharing your story, because I could so relate. I mean, I didn't come from a family of metaphysics. I came from a family of alcoholics. But the thing was, just feeling left out, not left out, but feeling like I did not fit in. It just traveled all through my life. And, feeling like I had an extra knowing of things. Even, I mean, I'm still not sure whether I'm considered, we're all intuitive, but with how to use that intuition, in its way. But right now what I'm experiencing is like, everything is crazy for me in my life. Like, I had a stroke in December, then I'm going through a divorce, and then I had lost my job 2 weeks later. And I know that it is a part of me, creating what I really want in my life, but it seems like every time I create something, I'm not fitting in. I can't find that home feeling or that connected feeling, and I was wondering, what was your take on that?
There are several ways to look at it. At the human level, when we feel that we're not included, we're not connected, we're not in a part of whatever the group is that we're in, sometimes it's a gift. Sometimes it's an opportunity. For example, I already mentioned that my parents were civil rights activists, and when I started school in first grade, we were in a place where they decided to integrate the schools. They had been white and colored only schools at that particular time. And so my very first experience of going to school was in that kind of environment. So I'm in room one in first grade, and I'm the only little African-American kid in the classroom. And the way the room was set up, all the other kids sat at this long table that was made up of small desks,
mm-hmm.
and my desk was on the other side of the room, literally on the other side of the teacher's desk. And at first, they had my desk turned towards the window and not turned towards the rest of the class.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for several months, it wasn't until really, I think, February or March of that school year that I actually got to sit at the table with all the other kids. Now, on one hand, you know, there are people who hear that story and they get upset, but it was a gift for me.
Okay.
Because it did several things for me. It allowed me to sit where I was as a little girl, you know, 6 years old, and become an observer of the world in the way that I learned so much about human nature.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that the kids who were mean to me were not just mean to me. Some of them really just had issues.
Right.
And they were mean to other kids too. They were bullies.
Mm-hmm.
I began to realize that even though it looked like I was separate from the group, that I was there. I really had such a sense of I was there on purpose. That I was there to learn something, and I also learned that how not to be dependent on somebody else outside of me to teach me.
Mm.
You know, it gave me a kind of independence of thought that children don't always get in classrooms where all the kids are expected to learn to read and write and do arithmetic, mathematics at the same time, to accomplish things well at the same time. So, at the human level, it can feel a little peculiar, but then when you stop and say, okay, well, what's the gift in this?
Yeah.
What am I doing?
Do you think that's a good thing to ask, Maisha? We should ask sometimes, right? When we go through something, what's the gift in this?
I think, what's the gift in it, or what am I being called to see in myself and to see in the world? What am I being called to see anew? What would I not see if I were, clumping with everyone else and following the mass mind, living life, in goose step with the cultural norms, right?
That's so true, because I think I've developed an incredible gift of compassion and creativity, because I had to learn how to not think like the mass mind, But still, it comes with the isolation still. And being an African-American woman and, from a human level, it gets all jumbled up, and I can't pull it apart and only pull out the gift, at that time.
Here's the thing that kind of came to me, and maybe in sharing it will help you. I discovered that I am more than an African American. I mean,
yes.
That's such a small part of who I am. I really understand myself as a universal being. I know I came in this particular costume, this particular earth suit, on purpose, and so I'm not in any way negating that aspect of it. But I recognize the universality of being. You talk about the compassionate heart. Through the compassionate heart, I was able to see that when people called me names, I wasn't the only one being called names, that I could see it happening, within the other circles of children. And I could also see how other people's feelings would get hurt over different things. And so it made me a kind of champion for the underdog. When I left that school and we moved to Philadelphia, I have to tell you that I was not willing to participate in any of the games that children play sometimes about teasing others.
Mm-hmm.
I understood. Mm-hmm. I want to know parts of that. And if anything, I would be the one who would kind of stand up and say, stop it. Why are you doing this? So sometimes we're being called to stand in a particular way in life. And it's not that we're in separation from others, but we're being given the opportunity to develop that inner muscle, if you want to call it that, of the compassionate heart, of the insightful one in the midst of the mass, who can stand and say, here I stand, I'm standing in integrity. I'm standing in love. I'm standing in peace and in harmony. And please join me.
Yes.
I think too what we're moving into, especially with this Aquarian age, with the individual blending more consciously with the collective. In other words, you're celebrating the individual, and individuating out, but not to the form of separation.
Right.
We learned a lot in this society and in this world about separating out, but now we're seeing that to that oneness, and I think we have to move beyond the labels, the titles, but I think we have to do it consciously, that I am more than this. I am not just this.
Yes.
You know, I'm not my neighborhood. I'm not my what's in my bank account. I'm not, because otherwise that ties you into the lower vibrational beta, if you will, mainstream consciousness, that's not where the designers are, the artists. Those are not the progressive. Those are not the Picassos and the Einsteins. We want to be the 8 to 10%. By the time stuff gets to the mainstream, dumped in the mainstream, it's diluted. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's an end product or byproduct expression.
Right.
So I think that's what's needed, and where everyone is, hopefully more and more going, right, is beyond that over-identification of the separated form.
Well, who we are in our humanity is such a small part of who we are.
If
we can look at the two aspects of ourselves, our humanity and our divinity, that which is the greater aspect of us is that which is in the invisible. And that which is seen is like not even the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. And so Bruce Lipton, who wrote Biology of Belief, has a section in the book where he talks about how they can measure they can pick up the brain waves of, we know you can measure the brain waves, you'll determine whether we're in beta, alpha, theta, delta, of all human beings. Newborns, they've discovered that infants from birth to three, that we are essentially emitting delta brainwaves. Now, anybody who knows anything about brainwaves knows that when you're talking about delta, you're talking about sleep, deep sleep, and hypnosis, trance.
Yeah.
Now, and it's not until we're 12 years old that we begin to emit more often during the day beta brainwaves, which is like normal waking consciousness. Essentially, we may be at the beta alpha threshold in this conversation, for example.
Right.
And to me, that's like an awesome thing to be aware of. That means that as spiritual beings coming into a human life, we enter into this earth suit as infants. Really, you could say prenatally.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we agree to come into this world and be hypnotized, mesmerized, programmed and conditioned to believe ourselves to be a certain way, which means that it's not the conditioning that we have as soul beings. It's the conditioning we agree to. We land in a family, and the beliefs of that family, that community, that culture, that country, then will shape our identity. But the truth of the matter is, it doesn't really define who we are.
Right.
It's kind of a game that we're playing with ourselves. I see the infinite one, the cosmic being, that some people call God, whatever you want to call it, having a really good time taking on all of the expressions of all of us in the world as a form of entertainment for itself. Right?
Yes. So, I think that's what we have to remember. It's a game, right? I mean,
yes.
We moved it on to the play of consciousness. I think somewhere we forgot that it was a game.
Yes, we forgot it. Well, think about this. I find it funny that as human beings, we create entertainment for ourselves. Things from benign romantic comedies to horror movies like Saw 5. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right? When you look at what Hollywood puts out and what we pay to go see, the novels that we pay to read, the kinds of stories that we tell for our entertainment that have a full range of drama in them, then if we are emanations of the divine. We're made in the image and the likeness. Then
right.
doesn't it stand to reason that our lives around the world are part of the entertainment of the divine presence itself, for itself, right? You're taking on
right.
all these different roles, but at the end of the day, whatever our day is, knowing that it's like as an actor, when you take on a role and you play it as well as you can, you get as much into that character as possible. But when they say cut, you know who you are. But every once in a while, you'll find an actor who will get so caught up in a role that when the role is over, it might take them a couple of years, and in some cases, in this lifetime, they may never let it go, where they keep playing that same character in their real lives.
Beautiful.
But for most of us, when the play is over or the movie is over, we come back to ourselves without any problem. And so the divine presence always knows what it is, who it is, how it is, and yet entertains itself by enacting this cosmic drama that we call human life.
Mm.
So if we when we look at it that way, then I see it as an opportunity to know that whatever we've dropped into in this lifetime, whatever circumstances, whatever kind of family we've dropped into, that ultimately our task is to discover that that doesn't define us, that there's a greater aspect of who we are that is so beyond that, that there comes a point that we get to laugh and say, oh, I've just been playing that role. Let me look at all of this infinite potentiality that is really who I am and know that I can release that and become however and whoever I choose to be. We really do have that kind of possibility. The writer Alan Watt wrote a book back in the 50s called The Book on the taboo against knowing who you are. And in it he talks about how God is playing hide and seek with itself. And that's what life is. And what we get to do is to find ourselves, and in finding ourselves know that whatever we thought we were, whatever our family defined us as, or the culture, the society defined us as, really is not the truth of our being.
No, it's not. So how can we not forget? What do you suggest?
Yes, that's the question.
How can we not forget?
Yeah. Listen to the archives over and over.
How can we remember?
Yeah.
How can we put it back together? How can we come to know it? Well, we do know it. When we can stop ourselves and still our minds and get quiet and just know that our hearts beat, our eyes blink, our cells are replicating in every moment. 350 billion cells are renewed every day out of the 100 trillion that our bodies, our physical forms are made out of. And that there is this intelligence, obviously, that is keeping all of this working without a conscious thought for many of us. Our hearts beat. We breathe, right? And just taking moments to breathe consciously and remember, oh, that's right, there is something within me that is greater than my conscious mind, greater than my conscious perception of myself, that is keeping this life force in this physical form. Stop for a moment and realize that mentally we can travel to all places within the universe. So obviously we're not all our bodies. We're not all our social conditioning. Our minds are free through imagination, through inner visioning, whatever you want to call it, to travel forward and backwards. We can go and look at our past things that have happened. We can project forward and envision what possibilities are. We can even in this moment, if you're not at home, you can mentally picture your house and actually walk through your house and see whether you left the lights on or the television running or the iron still plugged, which means then that we begin in those moments to celebrate the greater aspects of our being that are beyond what is visible. To me, that's the beginning of remembrance. That's the beginning of knowing that there's so much more to who we are than our conscious mind has been programmed to consider.
Well, and to me, these successive awakenings that keep happening, I mean, we're in the quickening cycle now, is about that remembering, you know, remembering more and more. I like also, Maisha, what you're saying, because I think it can be a good exercise even for people to do, is to allow the mind to go non-local, allow it to wander. Like what you're saying, if you're not at home, you can go and, you know, kind of peruse the house to see, did I leave that there or where is that? I think it's like, it's like a muscle.
Yes.
We have to keep
using
this awareness or tapping into this awareness.
And Michelle, for one of your meditations, you asked us to, you know, go up and up and up and look, get an aerial view of life or where we're at. I love that because it helps expand that we're more than just where we're at, you know, in a solid form.
Yeah, I do. I do it all the time. Well, yeah, I do it all the time. I do when I get up in the morning. Because what happens from, and probably Dr. Maisha can talk about this too, but what happens, and we learn this in, you know, holistic health counseling, transpersonal psychology, and even some forms of hypnotherapy, when we learn that the body-mind link throughout the day, living more with just, you know, beta consciousness or, you know, things like on the news or what you hear, only going by the tangible. When fear starts coming in, you can sense your body literally starts contracting in energetically but also physically. You can see people that have lived for many, many years more fear-based or chronically fear-based. Their shoulders will be slightly hunched over, the head a little down, just like people that use their head too much, mm-hmm. you know, the head will be more prominent.
Mm-hmm.
The inner child, the stomach will be, you know, more prominent. So what happens, because the physical body is, you know, they say a quarter or less than who we truly are, we're these rungs and rungs of light and energy, vortexes of light and energy. So when you do those expanding or ascension or alignment meditations, you tap in through the subtle energy into that resonant field, you start feeling that you're more than just the body. And automatically when you start doing that, you become less fearful because you realize that you're not just this little I mean, I'd be scared too, if you know. And when I do get fearful, you know what? I always notice it's when I think that I'm doing it, that my ego personality is all there is and is doing, you know, everything. But if I can connect into that infinite mind, or, you know, non-local mind, universal mind, God energy, that pranic life force energy, then I feel very taken care of because it's a higher principle, right? It's a more No matter how much study or training we do of the ego personality, it's never going to be, you know, right, everyone? As much as infinite mind.
Well, you know, the ego, I think, gets a bad name. And,
oh, I love
you know, yes, you got to love it. And
oh, yeah.
I figure we wouldn't have one. It's part of creation. It's part of, you know, our created being. So there has to be good in it. To me, it's the that which anchors our individuality in this world. And it's only when we are so busy looking down at the pointed reference of the ego that we begin to think that that's all we are.
Yeah.
Rather than looking up, it's like looking up to the high mountain, really, and all those ancient mystical metaphors for rising up into the greater aspect of our being, going to the mountaintop. Lifting our eyes to the hills, from whence cometh our help, so to speak. Lifting up so that the ego turns towards the greater aspect of the being
as
the directing force directing presence of the life, of the human life. So, and in the greater aspect of who we are, it is so clear that we are connected. It is so clear that there is no separation from one to another. All the separation is the illusion that our physical body gives us an idea that we're all separate beings.
Right.
And it's like, okay, I used the metaphor of the iceberg before, but let me use the mountain. You know, we look at the mountain, and the mountain seems to be set apart from the rest of the land, especially if it's right there at the edge of the ocean. But what we forget is that the mountain is connected to the landmass all over the earth, even though the ocean is there.
Right.
The mountains from one side of the ocean to the other are not disconnected. They're all connected, even though, you know, the Himalayas seem to be standing tall on their own, and the Alleghenies, you know, here in the U.S. and the Alps in Europe seem to be distinct and different land masses. But underneath it all, when you come down to the center of the earth, there's no separation at all. And so the same thing is true in terms of our physical forms are kind of like the mountains. But when we get beyond the physical form and we recognize that I'm more than flesh, I'm more than this physical form, it's like you walk into a room, and let's say you were really in a great mood, you were really happy, you walk into this room, and after about 5 minutes, you're agitated, you're ready to curse somebody out, you know, and you're going, what happened to me? And you really think something's wrong with you, and then if you're still for a moment, you realize you walked into an emotional field that had already been created by the people who were in the room.
Yes.
Because we broadcast from our hearts, from our heart center, and this is measured out physically at least 12 to 15 feet. You know, they can measure the heart rate variance wave. And when it's agitated, when we're agitated, the heart rate variance wave is very jagged.
Mm-hmm.
When we're calm and peaceful and happy, it's a very smooth curve to the wave of the heart rate variance, of the heartbeat. And we're always transmitting and broadcasting. So I walk into the room and suddenly, you know, my mood shifts. I can stop and realize, okay, this isn't my stuff.
Yeah, very important.
I can consciously, in that moment, take a few deep breaths through the heart and remember, just for 5 seconds, a moment when I was in absolute joy, or a moment of beholding a most beautiful scene. And it changes my heart rate variance back to the smooth sine wave. And in that moment, I'm broadcasting that sense of peace or joy or beauty. And then I begin to change the vibration of the room.
Mm-hmm.
But so we begin to see that I'm not disconnected from the human beings who are around me. Our fields of energy are interwoven, absolutely interwoven. There's a web of life that we're all connected to, a web of creation that we're all connected to that the shamans know. You know, the priests of every in indigenous culture, the true priests of any culture, and priestesses, let me make sure you know I mean all people, have that knowing that it's like a web of light that connects us all, and we can activate the packets between us and everything and everyone consciously intending to broadcast peace, harmony, love, joy, you know, any of those vibrations that are kind of the perfect vibrations at the zero point of cosmic consciousness, if I can put it that way.
That
Yes, yes.
Dr. Mayesh, we have a question just out of curiosity. Kathy in the chat room is asking, why is it some of us can remember sometimes even the most minute thing as a child but can't remember our past lives? Do you have any thought on that?
Sure. And, you know, Mayesha will do. We can drop the doctor thing. I used to do past life regression hypnosis years ago. And it was fascinating to do and fascinating to work with people and to see what discoveries were made. At the same time, I began to realize that if we become so preoccupied with who we were and what we were doing in another lifetime, sometimes we stop fully living out this adventure in the present lifetime. So I think sometimes people are not remembering past lives for a number of reasons. It may be that we live in a culture, a society, where the idea of reincarnation is not a dominant idea. As a matter of fact, there are some families where when the little children are talking about when they were big people before, when they were adults before, those conversations are shut down very quickly. And so very quickly the kids realize they aren't supposed to talk about whatever it is they're perceiving about another lifetime. And so that kind of shuts us off, conditions us not to pay attention to that information, because it's not information that has been validated by the general populace within the society. There are cultures where it's understood that we've lived many lifetimes. And so when children emerge with these conversations, the adults welcome it because they want to know. And they understand the importance of gathering that information. So there are two parts to what I'm saying. One is that sometimes perhaps we don't remember because the important point is for us not to be so preoccupied by what came before that we don't live the present life. And the other is the cultural conditioning that may have turned our attention away from those impulses that come up that are references to a past life.
Mm-hmm. I know, if I may, because in my practice I do regression work, past life regression work, but I, a long time ago, made a choice, a decision, that unless it related to a pattern, you know, for someone to clear or heal or move through or, you know, repattern, reconfigure it, however you want to look at it, that I wouldn't do it. Because a lot of times, and I don't know if it's still, if this is still going on now, but I know years ago, people just wanted to know, and of course I'm not saying, Kathy, this is going on with you, but they just wanted to know, was I Nefertiti? Was I, I just have a feeling I was Cleopatra. And I kept, you know, I would tell people, I go, God, you know, it's real interesting who everybody's choosing to be, you know. But, yeah, and because, and also I would tell people, I said, you know, because on some level, because it's all now anyway, it's all happening now, and they're all just various aspects of self. So sometimes it's easier to go past life to handle something or clear something rather than seeing it and processing it as something that I'm doing now or is happening now. You see, so I kind of agree with you. It can pull people out. Or sometimes people get tripped up and say, well, this happened to me. Which everybody, by the way, do not believe in, you know, the karma that, you know, I did something and now I'm doing, I have this lifetime, I'm back, you know. Like, but I think people can get caught up in that. But yet it's a great exploring, I think, if you relate it to what's your pattern and where you are now, or are you going and retrieving information from an expanded self or you know, another dimension, if you will. What's your thought on that?
I would agree with you on all of that. When I was doing it, and I haven't done it now for about 20 years, when I was doing it, I only did it within the context of exploring what the patterns of in the present life. What would illuminate the patterns? So
then it can be very powerful, can't it?
It can be very, yes, it can. And at the same time, when I look at reincarnation, I remember reading this book when I was a teenager called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. And I don't know whether you ever stumbled on that one. But in the book, in the former Soviet Union, they were doing a tremendous amount of research with psychic abilities and you know, just all kinds of mental science and spiritual science, even though they were supposedly anti-religious and anti-spiritual. But here's the point. There was I think it was in Bulgaria, there was a group experimenting with hypnosis and another kind of reincarnation, which I found absolutely fascinating. They would hypnotize folks who, in their normal waking consciousness, demonstrated absolutely no artistic talent. They were drawing stick figures, right? And that was it. Or no real musical acumen, no real musical talent evident. You know, they were playing chopsticks, and that was it, on the piano. Mm-hmm. And they would hypnotize them and say to them, you are Rembrandt, Michelangelo, you know, Picasso, Matisse, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And suddenly these people would begin to paint in the style, draw and paint in the style of Rembrandt, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, you know, whoever it was they were hypnotized to believe. And on the music side, they would tell them, you know, you're Mozart or Prokofiev, the great Russian composer. And they would begin, folks who could only play chopsticks, you know, began to emerge with these newfound abilities. And so as I was reading this, you know, those years back, I was like, wow, you know, we can really tap into the minds and the lives of whoever has been on the planet. Because like you said, the mm-hmm. past, the present, and the future exist simultaneously. There's only this eternal now, you know, in which you know, all the past, the present, and the future all exist at different frequencies. And so we don't see the past in this moment.
Right.
Because if we did, I mean, just imagine.
You'd be overwhelmed.
Everybody would be overwhelmed. For example, back in the 70s, there was a magazine called Ramparts. It was an avant-garde magazine. And I remember reading this article in which they talked about how the CIA or the FBI, you know, one of those intelligence agencies, put that in quotation marks, had invented a camera that could take pictures of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And they had only gotten it to the point where it could take a picture back an hour and a half. And, you know, it was kind of the proof that past moment is still in existence, but vibrating at a frequency that is beyond our human perception, visual perception, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, I just skipped from my reincarnation example back to the simultaneous time.
That it all fits in. We're on a ride.
Right. And so I just want to make sure I anchor it and say, so the truth of it is that there's, from my vantage point anyway, is, and lots of people share this, that there's only one. There's only a cosmic one. Having, expressing itself as the allness of being, as everything that is. Which means then that there is a way that we can tap into all that is, to everyone. That I can tap into the memories, the life of any individual who's ever been on the planet and ever will be, who's on the planet right now. Because the veil of separation is simply that. It's a veil that just blows in the wind. And we respect it, sometimes too much, but we can lift it. And in lifting it, we can behold all that is. There's nothing that is away from us, separated from us, nothing that we cannot know about. Because in the
we are opening to lift the veil. We're opening to lift the veil more and more.
Yes, we are. And it's fun.
It's fun. Yes, thank God for saying that. It's fun. It's fun to live this way. It's fun to connect and feel tingly all over.
Yes.
And use our telepathic, you know, way of being, you know. It's fun to live more multidimensionally. That's the thing. Fun. I just love it because look at all these playmates, create mates we have.
Yes. It's a blast, you know. We have to get over the fear of it. And the fear is something that we've been taught.
Yeah.
And it's not the truth of our being. It's not who we really are. It's we get to shake off the cultural vestiges, the cultural camouflage that mm-hmm. has been tacked on us,
mm-hmm.
that has said no to some experiences and yes to a small group of validated experiences in life.
Wow. Well, we're winding down here, although everybody in the chat room, too, and everyone that's called in just feels this vibrational frequency that we have just up-leveled. It's just amazing, Maisha. All of us, we can feel it. We're just, everybody's commenting. I really want to thank you for being here and everybody that's been in this resonant field. Even though we're parting right now because the show is closing, we still remain connected. We'll connect again physically, but we're all in this together. We're all in this converging flow of this existential awakening.
Thank you,
Maisha,
for inviting me. Thank you.
Have you back again. And everyone, if you just connect in through the heart and feel that energy, that converging flow, that is us emerging through us as us. And in that I say, until next time, keep awake. Blessings.
Peace and light.